I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company. Today, from New York, cultural journalist Hua Xu. His memoir, Stay True, was named one of the top five nonfiction books of the year. Stay True, a memoir by Hua Xu, Xu spelled H-S-U, revolves around a college friendship he had with a fellow student, Ken, who was senselessly murdered in a carjacking less than 3 years after they first met. An exploration of grief, friendship, Asian American identity, and memory, Stay True is also a coming-of-age story through music and pop culture, even fashion. Not only did the editors of the New York Times Book Review name it one of the top five nonfiction titles of 2022, but the Washington Post, Time, Vulture, and The Atlantic also included it on their best of the year lists. Hua Xu was born in 1977 in Champaign, Urbana, a city in central Illinois most famous for its university. His parents had emigrated separately from Taiwan to go to graduate school in the U.S. and later met at the University of Illinois. Eventually, the family settled in Cupertino in Northern California's Silicon Valley, where Hua Xu grew up. Hua Xu studied at Berkeley and then got a Ph.D. in American Studies at Harvard. He made his name as a pop music critic, but he's also written about food, books, Asian American history, and politics. And currently, he's putting together an essay collection about imposter syndrome. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, Art Forum, Slate, as well as The New Yorker, where he's been a staff writer since 2017. Hua Xu is a professor of English at Bard College. He spoke to me from his home in Brooklyn, New York. At the core of your memoir, Stay True, is a tragic and traumatic event. Your best friend, Ken, is murdered in an apparently random carjacking and robbery. It happened in July 1998 in between your junior and senior years at Berkeley. Almost immediately after Ken's death, you said you felt the urgent need to write everything down about him and your friendship. Why?
You know, I'm not really sure why I started doing it. Writing is something that always interested me. Like, it was just sort of the way I process things. But yeah, like immediately after we found out that he was gone, I went and bought a journal and started writing everything down. I think at the time it just seemed like a way to remember everything, to kind of keep this archive, maybe. But over time I realized that it also represented a place to go. You know, writing was a way to feel as though I was being really present, but not be present at the same time. You know, it was just sort of a place to escape to, just to kind of lose myself on the page.
And lose yourself on the page in the company of Ken? Was that part of it?
Yeah, I liked to think that, you know, I guess I believe in ghosts in a certain way. Like, I liked to think that he could still access things I was writing. So sometimes it was writing to him. Sometimes it was just trying to remember things so I would never forget. You know, I think, you know, we sort of take for granted often that the people we share memories with or the other half of an inside joke, that they'll always be there, right, to remind you of where the joke started. And I think I just instantly realized that that was never going to happen again. And so I just wanted to, you know, keep this account of the kind of banal ecstasies that made up our friendship, or any friendship, really.
That's a great expression, banal ecstasies. Sounds a little oxymoronic, but
I think when you're young, a lot of things are, you know, it's like you experience things in such extremes that even though a lot of the day-to-day of being a college student is pretty quotidian and boring, you know, you also find these pockets of just extreme joy in them, too.
You also collected ephemera, things that belonged to Ken or were connected to a memory, like a matchbook or his baseball cap or an old jacket. What was that about?
I think that was probably just something that it was already an innate part of my personality. I think I was just always someone who, you know, was collecting things as a small kid. You know, I think typical of many kind of people who grew up in North America in the 1980s, I would collect baseball cards or comic books, things like that. So I think I've just always been fascinated with these relics from the past. You know, just the idea that something could survive for that long, something that other people didn't necessarily treasure the way you do. I think it just took on a very different nature in the aftermath. Like, I think I just thought that these objects had some kind of talismanic power that maybe they would, you know, bring back, or maybe they would trigger some kind of memory, some memory that I wanted to hold on to. So, yeah, I became really fixated upon holding on to things, whether it was like articles of clothing or receipts, old school assignments and notebooks, old books. For some reason, I thought that having all of these things close to me would provide some kind of solace, but also maybe offer me some clue as to what I should be doing or what should I be thinking about.
Because after the book was published, you said, I think the talismanic effect of these objects has disappeared. And I was wondering, what were their magical properties?
You know, in the end, I'm not sure they had any magical properties beyond as these, beyond as reminders. You know, I think there was a time when, you know, as you noted before, his killing was so senseless and sudden. But for a while, I thought, you know, if I had all of these things, if I collected enough data about it, like if I thought enough about the conditions of the night it happened, that I could make sense of it. But, you know, in retrospect, there is no sense to be made. It was a senseless tragedy. It was quite random. It just is a thing that happened and everything changed. And so I think the idea that, you know, somehow having these old hats, right, or having these old movie ticket stubs, like they don't actually have any power beyond the memories that they triggered. And once I was able to kind of recover and write down those memories or think about what story they told, they just sort of returned to just being these old things. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. You and Ken met as freshmen living in the same dorm at the University of California, Berkeley. And you write, when I first met Ken, I hated him. And then you go on to tell us why. I wonder if you could read a short passage from Stay True.
Sure. The first time I met Ken, I hated him. Ken lived too loud a life, at least by my standards. I had met hundreds of him, hundreds of times before. I was 18, in love with my moral compass, perpetually suspicious of anyone whose words came too easily. He was a genre of person I actively avoided, mainstream. Ken was flagrantly handsome. His voice betrayed no insecurity. He lived on the fourth floor, just above us, and his room was filled with reminders of who he'd been in high school. A photo of his girlfriend back home, white and blonde and conventionally pretty. One of him with his friends, dressed up like refs, heckling their crosstown rivals at a basketball game. He had good manners, which served him well at his after-school job selling children's shoes at a department store. He was adept at charming both sticker shop parents and their impatient children. He could treat a hangover, and he opened the door for others. He knew how to order at restaurants. He seemed eager for adult life. High school had been a dream for Ken, and there were few signs that college would be any different. He hoped to become an architect. During the first week of school, he was tapped by the fraternity up the hill, the most diverse one, he pointed out. They were grooming him for a leadership position.
Hua Shu, reading from Stay True, a memoir. You go on to describe yourself in relation to Ken. You say, I was quiet, Ken was loud, he projected confidence, I found confident people suspicious. He asked questions out of earnest curiosity. I asked questions that were skeptical or coolly condescending. Mostly, I never wanted to let on when I didn't know something. I mean, you don't come out looking so great here. How did you see yourself as a character in this book?
You know, I think that I'm the caricature in the book. Like, I'm the book is about me, but I think that it's much I'm much more protective about my friends and about Ken than I am about myself. And look, I mean, I think like many people who were probably, you know, radicalized by Nirvana and DIY culture and alternative culture and zines, I was much more judgmental than a lot of my friends. And so I think in retrospect, it's quite easy to chuckle about some of my pretensions, which I think probably still linger in me somewhere. But yeah, it was sort of funny to realize how ridiculous I was in certain ways.
Although at the time, of course, you took yourself very seriously.
Yeah, no, I think I took myself very seriously. And I think that's what made it so funny, was thinking back and realizing that I was taking myself so seriously. And yet, you know, someone like Ken saw through that in a way. Like, he sort of understood that everything we put out is to sort of catch the eye of others or to be noticed. And even I, who claimed that I didn't care if anyone noticed me, sort of desperately wanted to be noticed. And so it was kind of freeing in a way to realize that an aspect of the book could be me just not necessarily making fun of myself, but just sort of making light of my own kind of idealism as a teenager. And that there's room for that alongside a story that ends up being kind of sad as well.
Well, the first time you spent any time with Ken was when he asked you to take him shopping for clothes. What did he see in your sense of fashion?
Well, I presumed that he saw, you know, someone who dressed like someone who was incredibly cool and who, you know, was dressed with real intentionality. You know, I really liked wearing thrift store clothes. I liked wearing kind of anachronistic things, at least at the time. What seemed anachronistic, like cardigans and you know, 70s ski sweaters and corduroy and things like that. And so he asked me to take him shopping. I presumed that he wanted to dress like me, but in reality, it turned out that he was going to a 70s party, and he just wanted to look really, really funny and garish. So he thought that I could help him with that task.
How did you get from that excursion to becoming such close friends?
I don't know. I think I just found it. I had fun going shopping with him and saying, like, oh, you should try this, not knowing that his intention was to look like funny and goofy rather than cool. But you know, it was fun to hang out, and I think I just found it charming that he sort of understood what each of his friends or what people brought to the table, if that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. I think I really wanted friends who were exactly like me. You know, I wanted people who understood all the references I was making and who listened to all the same bands and who were into all the same sections of the movie store. But, you know, he was really a lot more open-minded than I was. And I think that's something that I think I realized at the time, but I didn't appreciate at the time. And so naturally, he understood that, you know, like, Hua is the person I can go to with this problem. The problem being, like, I don't know where to buy really ugly clothes. So,
but it evolved into such a kind of such closeness. I mean, really, a kind of falling in love in a way.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think that, you know, like, in a way, it's a pretty generic story, right? Just that people who don't assume they're going to be friends become very close friends. I think that what makes it unusual is just that once Ken died, like, it became this friendship to ponder rather than a friendship that evolved or grew or maybe fizzled out. We'll never know. But for me, it was this really, you know, it was like a really formative experience in my life to just sort of realize how wrong I'd been about someone and then just kind of be, I don't want to say haunted, but reflect for years later as to sort of what they saw in me and what they gave me.
One thing you and Ken had in common was your Asian American heritage, though Ken's family was Japanese American and had been in the U.S. for several generations. Your parents emigrated from Taiwan before you were born. How significant were these differences in your backgrounds culturally?
You know, I think they were they were important. There was something I noticed. It's a sort of obscure part of Asian American identity, I guess, that you know, these cross-generational differences are noticed. But, you know, for someone like me, my parents were kind of newer immigrants. Seeing someone who was Japanese American like Ken, and in the history of the United States, sort of Japanese Americans tend to be a bit more assimilated, or they've oftentimes been in the United States longer than other nationalities. You know, it's just sort of this fascinating way in which you feel an affinity for someone, but you also feel very different from them because he seemed so much more at ease. Of course, that was my projection. Like, I think that was just part of my initial misapprehension of who he was. You know, like he also had shared a lot of the anxieties or fears or dreams that I did. But, you know, it's something that initially I thought, like, ah, this is another way in which this is another way in which we're different, you know. But in reality, we weren't that different after all.
Well, you talk about how children of recent immigrants feel discomfort on a molecular level. What does that mean?
I think that for a lot of children of recent immigrants, or children of immigrants just writ large, I don't even think it's an Asian thing necessarily, but I think when you and your parents are both kind of assimilating at the same time, that sense of discomfort just gets a little heightened because, you know, even though your parents are authorities, even though they're adults, like, they're navigating this culture just as you are. And so I think that when I looked back, I realized that there were things that I wanted to explain to me that my parents were trying to figure out for themselves, too. I think that there was just a way in which we were both parent and child trying to figure out who we were in the United States, in American culture. We're trying to understand what we could ask of the culture. And I think for me, it just sort of manifested in this discomfort. You know, like, am I wearing my clothes right? Am I fitting in? Is it worth trying to fit in? Maybe I can't fit in, so maybe I should invest in never fitting in, things like that.
Your parents both came to the United States as graduate students. Your father arrived in 1965. What were they looking for?
They were just looking to further their educations. Taiwan in the 1960s and early 70s was not as developed as it is now, and they just didn't have as many opportunities there as they would if they studied in the United States. So they arrived separately. I mean, they didn't know each other, so they met in the United States. When they came to the United States, they were just looking to further their education. Like, I don't think they thought about whether they would stay. They had no sense of like where they wanted to end up. All they knew was that, you know, my dad was studying physics, my mom was studying public health, that the schools in the United States were superior, and that this was a place where more opportunities could open up for them. Over time, they met, they fell in love, they decided to stay. They had a son, they moved around. And I think during that journey, you know, a sense of possibility became clearer for them, but it wasn't the sense of possibility that initially drew them. You know, they didn't really have that sense of, like, the American dream when they came to the United States. That's something that they sort of learned about when they got here.
Yeah, you talk about the push and pull dynamic for immigrants, that something pushes you from home, something else pulls you far away. At one point, you allude to your parents coming to the U.S. and the sacrifices they made for their child, you, and your father laughs. What was your, I mean, can you expand, just
yeah,
tell
course.
Us that story?
Yeah. You know, it's funny in a way because in a lot of works of like Asian American literature or like coming of age stories, there's this moment where, you know, the child understands the sacrifices that the parents have made. You know, like, we came to this country for you, we're here because of you, and so you need to work hard, you need to do X, Y, and Z. My parents never really kind of bought into that narrative, but I think it's impossible to kind of see your parents figuring out their own way, and eventually, you know, they led this like somewhat complicated life where they would go back and forth in the United States and Taiwan and not feel a sense of obligation to them, you know. So, you know, one day I went to my dad with this sense of like, oh, you know, like indebtedness and gratitude and whatnot. And he was just like, I don't know where you learned that from. Like, that's not at all why we came here. Like, I didn't know that I was going to have a family or a kid, or you weren't in the picture when you got here. Like, this was all for me. Like, I came here because I needed to get a graduate degree. Your mom came here for graduate degree. Like, none of these sacrifices were for you. So you don't need to feel indebted to us in that way. And I don't know. It was like, it was very funny, but it was also like a very... you know, humane and liberating thing to say, because, you know, he could have just turned the screw a bit and said like, yes, yeah, and that is why you should do X, Y, and Z.
Right, and guilted you out of everything.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
In another instance where what seems like a reversal of the classic immigrant story, coming to America, the land of opportunity, your father went back to Taiwan after working for more than 20 years as an engineer in Silicon Valley. What was behind that move?
When they left Taiwan, there just weren't the economic opportunities or social opportunities that there were by the 80s and the 90s. And so, you know, when my father was working his way up the corporate ladder in the U.S. in the 80s, at the same time, the semiconductor industry in Taiwan was really flourishing. And so that industry was always looking to bring Taiwanese executives back. And that's what happened with my dad. Like, it was, weirdly, it was actually quite common where I grew up in the Bay Area, in the Silicon Valley, for these sort of like Taiwanese American men in their, I guess, in their like 50s at the time, to actually go back to Taiwan. And so when I was in high school, I had a few classmates whose dads also worked in Taiwan while the family lived in the South Bay. And we would sometimes see each other at the airport dropping our dads off after visits home. I think it was just a sense of kind of mild exasperation about the corporate ladder in the U.S., just opportunities, just sort of understanding that there were limits to how far you could go. Whereas in Taiwan, there were these opportunities where it seemed like the opportunities were boundless there.
Well, you and your mother would join your father in Taiwan in the summer and during school breaks, spending 2 or 3 months there every year. How at home did you feel there?
I did not enjoy it. Again, I was a teenager, and I think as a teenager, you just don't... It's just very hard to actually be present as a teenager or to understand the opportunities that you've been given. And so I think my main complaint was like, well, I'd rather just hang out with my friends this summer. You know, I'd rather just learn how to rollerblade around the Silicon Valley. Like, I didn't really want to go just hang out with my parents for 2 months in Taiwan. In retrospect, like, these were great months. You know, like, I would just kind of watch TV and explore cities and just sort of spend a lot of time with my family. But of course, you know, at the age of 14, 15, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to watch the newest blockbusters and like listen to and watch MTV and all these things that were very hard to do in Taiwan at the time. So yeah, it took me a while to actually understand how important and meaningful it was to have this chance to go back to Taiwan so much as a teenager.
Before your father left for Taiwan, he bought a pair of fax machines, one for himself and one for you in California. They played an important role in your relationship. How did that work?
Right. So a fax machine, before email, it was a fairly cheap way to communicate internationally. In theory, we got the fax machines because I was struggling with math, and my dad was very good at math, and so he would help me with my homework, and by help, he would basically do my homework for me, and I would just sort of copy down the answers when I woke up in the morning, because sort of like a perfect time difference where I could urgently fax him my questions at night and then know that he would have dutifully replied by the morning. Besides the math homework, though, he would also ask me about school. He would also ask me about how things are going in the United States. I would tell him about things I was into, you know, like bands I liked, how the local sports teams are doing. Like, you know, it was basically just our way of keeping up with each other. And I don't think I understood at the time how, I don't want to say worried, but just how interested he was in my kind of emotional development. I think he was really interested in just trying to be there as best as he could, even though he wasn't physically there. And so when I looked back on the faxes as I was writing this book, I realized that there were so many moments in which he was trying to really kind of reach out and connect and just offer a bit of wisdom or offer a bit of love in ways that as a teenager, I'm just like, all right, the answer is like this. All right, I'm writing down the answer. I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do with all this other stuff.
Well, one thing you and your father did have in common, although in very different ways, was an enthusiasm for music. How would you describe his taste?
I guess his tastes are kind of solidly like boomer. You know, he's just very, he had like a fantastic record collection of someone who went to college, I guess, or went to graduate school in the 1960s. So, you know, just like the Woodstock generation, you know, he had all the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Motown, great record collection. Classical music was also something that he was very enthusiastic about. As a child, like he was so into music that I thought music was just something like boring and adult. Like it was something that I had no interest in because I thought that only like, you know, parents were into music. So he would drag me to record stores when I was, you know, 9 or 10. And I would just think like, this is so boring. Like I'd rather be doing anything than this. Over time, I learned that, you know, like music is great. And that music is something that kind of helps. It's sort of like a special currency, like knowing a lot about music when you're in middle school or in high school. And so, I definitely learned a lot from him. And up until, I think, the early 90s, we would sort of listen to the same kinds of music on MTV. And then once he moved to Taiwan, he got engaged with it a lot less.
You give an example when you were as a kid in middle school, that your father and you were enthralled by the same music, but it showed us different things. And you give the example of Slash's, Slash's flamboyant guitar solo, "November Rain." What did each of you take from it?
Yeah, my dad was always into rock music, and so he would. It sounds absurd, but I have these like vivid memories of him tutoring me in math while he was listening to like Metallica or Guns N' Roses. And I think he was very drawn to the idea that these were virtuosos, you know, just that, you know, Slash from Guns N' Roses, like this was the 10,000 hours of practice manifesting in this like wild guitar solo. Whereas like I was just drawn to the wildness. I was just drawn to the idea of like, oh no, there's that, he's not practicing. That's just him channeling some higher spirit. So I think we were both drawn to similar things, but I saw it more as evidence of like, oh, like liberation or freedom or just freaking out. Whereas he saw it as like, no, Slash must have spent tens of thousands of hours practicing to get this good. Therefore, you should practice the things you're into as well.
Right.
I think we were both right, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's evidence on both sides of that one. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hua Xu, in your book, Stay True, about the loss of your friend Ken, you look to several thinkers, philosophers, and social scientists for their ideas about friendship. For instance, you quote the French philosopher Jacques Derrida as saying that a friend would choose knowing rather than being known. You were startled when you came across that quote. Why?
Because I'd always thought it was the other way around. I thought that it was about being known, not knowing. And I think that there's a sort of generosity of spirit in what Derrida wrote, what Aristotle wrote, what different thinkers who've taken seriously friendship have written. There is a sort of model for how to be a good person and how to be a generous person. And so much of that is tied up in like the selflessness of being a friend. Whereas I think I was always, you know, someone who wanted to be recognized, wanted to be noticed, not the person who wanted to do the noticing. In the book, because I'm revisiting this period of my life where I am sort of the type of person who would name drop Derrida without fully understanding what Derrida was saying, I thought that it actually made sense in the book to have these, you know, like it's very me as an 18-year-old to think like, well, to actually think about friendship, we must consult Jacques Derrida, you know. But in reality, like when I read Derrida's work on friendship, I thought like, wow, this is actually really meaningful to me. Like this is not something that I would have ever understood when I was younger, just this idea of seeing and being seen, of like recognizing and being recognized, how to actually tell someone's story without centering yourself in that story. I don't know, these became really important kind of ways of thinking about what friendship could actually be, especially in the absence of the friend.
I was so glad you quoted something from Derrida that I could understand.
Well, I actually thought that it's funny you say that, actually, because I definitely exhausted all of my understanding of Derrida in writing that chapter of the book. But what I really appreciated was this opportunity to quote people like Derrida or Aristotle or the anthropologist Marcel Mauss alongside like Ken and my father and my friends and my mother, and just sort of having that juxtaposition of other voices in the book was something that really appealed to me.
You're right, there are many currencies to friendship. Some friends complete us while others complicate us. Which would you prefer in a friend?
Well, when I was younger, I would definitely want the friend that completed me in like very precise ways. Like I have this collection of 7-inch singles from this band. Like you have the rest of them. Let's be friends so that we have like the full set. Like I think I was very into, you know, just these instrumental dimensions of friendship, as I think many people are. But I think as I've gotten older, and sort of obviously in the aftermath of Ken no longer being around, like that idea of just someone who disrupts you or someone who challenges you, not because they're trolling you or not because they don't deep down like love and appreciate you, that idea of being complicated by someone, it's such a gift, and it's something that really I think changes you for the better. At least that's what it was like for me.
As your friendship grew, you made mixtapes for Ken to introduce him to different music. He shared VHS tapes with you of his favorite movies and TV shows. And you mentioned the early 20th century French sociologist Marcel Mauss explored the practice of gifting across different cultures. What drew you to his ideas about friendship and this reciprocity of gifts?
You know, like in that work, a lot of anthropologists like Mauss and Malinowski were interested in kind of why members of different societies gave each other gifts, whether it was just like you were just like flexing on someone, and whether it was a power play or whether there were deeper resonances or other possibilities. And I was really drawn to this idea of delayed reciprocity, of gift giving as just a way of kind of opening up a social circle rather than entering into some sort of contractual obligation. I think I'd always thought, and I think many people think of gifts as just, you know, you give me A, I give you B. You're entering into this contract of friendship. But there's something about the sort of casual gifting that doesn't just sort of embody some sort of political imperative that Mauss and Malinowski were looking at, that really appealed to me. Just this idea that what we give each other isn't necessarily something that is tangible or follows some sort of regular interval, that it can be something different and that maybe it can produce a different relationship or different kind of friendship.
One of the things that Ken introduced you to or turned you on to was his favorite cult movie, one of his favorite cult movies, The Last Dragon. It's a kung fu comedy with a black hero who's obsessed with Asian culture. After watching for 10 minutes, you say you were convinced it was the greatest movie ever made. Why?
Yeah, I mean, it's like this 80s kind of post-blaxploitation film, but, you know, the protagonist, he's black, but he sort of thinks he's Asian, and then there are these Asian characters who talk in sort of like 70s blaxploitation slang. Like, it's just a very confused movie, but it's kind of delirious and delightful, and I think for us as Asian Americans and we would often debate, you know, whether we thought we would ever see people like us on screen. Like, we would talk about, I guess, what people today terms like representation, right? It was something that we were constantly enamored with. Like, I was always a bit cooler about things. I mean cooler, like, temperature-wise. Like, I thought, the day will never come, so, you know, why bother coveting this thing called representation? Whereas Ken always had much greater horizons. Like, he was much more demanding of the world. He was much braver in that regard. Like, he thought, like, you know, in this period of time we live in the 1990s, with, like, multiculturalism and reality TV and, like, alternative culture, like, there's still no room for us. Like, why not? So for us, watching a movie like The Last Dragon, which I think echoed a lot of things we were really interested in, like whether there was such thing as authenticity, like what it meant to be Asian American in relation to black and white. It sort of happened into our lives at a time when we were talking about all these things that the movie seemed to kind of accidentally take on in its characterization. And so he was obsessed with it. I became really obsessed with it. It might also be because we were watching it at like 4 a.m. And I think everything at that time of morning just seems more profound or seems even more intense. But yeah, it was a moment I still think about, actually.
Well, you're right. We came up with brilliant theories, but forgot to write them down.
Yeah. It was 4 a.m, so.
Have you ever longed to escape reality or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me wherever you get your podcasts.
Hua Shu, the night he died, Ken threw a housewarming party at his new apartment. You went early because you were going on to a rave afterwards with your girlfriend, Mira. You wanted to talk to Ken alone, but you kept getting interrupted. Can you describe that last time that you were together?
Yeah, it was, you know, my book is filled with these moments that probably wouldn't have been worth remembering were he still alive today. Does that make sense? Like,
yes.
So much of the book is about these moments that, in retrospect, were really freighted with possibility. Like, you're on the precipice of something, you just don't know it. But it's a night that I remember in like very vivid detail, because it was the last night I saw him. Like, it was a housewarming party. He was always sort of the more mature, worldly one among our friend group. And so the fact that he was calling it this housewarming party felt like, wow, we're really growing up. Like, it's a housewarming party. Like, even though it was just an apartment he was sharing with a couple other guys. We got there early, and the thing we would always do is just smoke cigarettes on the balcony. And so, you know, we went out to christen the balcony, and, you know, people kept coming out. I wanted to sort of have a moment to hang out with him before I was leaving. But, you know, I figured I would just see him the next day or see him on Monday or something. But yeah, I mean, it's a night that in retrospect feels very eerie, even though it was really could have just been a night like any other. Yeah.
Ken was attacked by three people while he was getting into his car later that night, and he was locked in the trunk. driven around and then shot. The killers were soon arrested and convicted. You said that for years you felt there was a mystery to be solved.
Yeah.
About Ken's murder. What were you hoping to find?
I don't know. But it's something that I felt like I felt like all the things that I'd held on to were clues. Clues to what? I don't know. But I just thought that there was some sense to be gleaned from all of this, right? Like so much of the past that I write about in the book is a past that many people experience. Like, you know, millions of people in college right now are having near identical experiences, right? Arguing about which burrito shop to go to, smoking on balconies, staying up all night, exchanging theories about what some TV show means. The only reason I wrote it all down is because of what happened that night, right? And the fact that I can't access him anymore. And so I think maybe it was just my mind thinking like, well, just collect all these clues, collect all of this archive of the past. You'll know what to do with it someday. Only there was nothing to do with it. Like there's no real sense to what happened. Like there's no alternate version of what could have happened. It just happened and we were left trying to deal with it. But it is a moment that I revisited a lot or have dwelled on a lot as a mystery. And I don't know why. I mean, maybe it's just sort of how people deal with these traumatic moments. They think about like what could have been, what the alternatives were. But at some point, you know, since the alternatives didn't happen, you're just sort of stuck with what actually did happen. And it took me quite a while to kind of realize that what I should be doing is looking forward and thinking about how this moment pushed me forward rather than trying to stay dwelt in the past.
When you came home from Ken's funeral, you said you couldn't listen to music that gave you pleasure, and you give the example of the Beach Boys song, God Only Knows. You, Ken, and your friends would spend hours driving around and singing along, not always in tune. What was so moving for you about the song and that experience of singing it together in the car?
You know, it's a good song, right? And that's how I liked it. I just sort of liked the song as it was recorded. And so as my friends would begin their own kind of awful three-part harmonies, it would drive me nuts. Like I would ask them to stop. I was like, no, this song is pure and beautiful on its own. Like, please do not sing along to it. But there was a kind of delirium to just listening to your friends all try and sing along to the song that I really loved. And it was something that almost supplanted the song in my mind, was just the experience of, you know, a bunch of people driving to get donuts, singing along to God Only Knows. And after Ken's death, it just became hard to return to music that was marked with such strong memories. I just kind of wanted to only listen to music that had no memories attached to it or music that didn't necessarily touch on emotions that I was trying to avoid. And so that was one of those songs. Like I just couldn't really listen to songs like that anymore. It reminded me too much of the past. It reminded me of like all the times I'd heard it before. And that's something that I was like actively trying to avoid.
Do you mind if I play a bit of it now?
Oh yeah, no. Go for it.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, oh, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me, so what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
Ken's murder put a stop to the exchange of music and movies and also to conversation. After he died, you began writing him letters. Could you read from one?
All right. That first night, after everyone had gone home, I typed a letter to him detailing everything I would miss. His soft skin and flatulence, our routines and inside jokes. I listed things he'd left behind, because he was always leaving things behind. The bandage affixed to the air freshener in my car. The lucky volleyball shirt still in my hamper in Cupertino. All that I'd learned about loyalty, time travel, treating a hangover with steak eggs and a side of pancakes. The screen names of the right-wing adults we used to ridicule on AOL. Truth Gator. I told him about that night with Mira. How Gwen and Alec were holding up. How much we needed him back. So be with me, okay, Ken? Can you stay with me a little longer?
Huashu, reading from his memoir, Stay True. How do you think writing these letters to Ken helped you deal with your grief?
That's an interesting question. I think it probably forced me to verbalize certain things that would have been difficult to verbalize otherwise. I mean, I think something I thought about a lot during this process was how writing is a way of freezing time, right? Writing is a way of time. Writing is a form of time travel. I've written this story, turned myself, Ken, and a bunch of our friends into these characters, right? But in real life, like, who's to say the friendship would have continued unimpeded? You know, like, so the book exists because of this rupture. And so I think writing the letters forced me to be more honest about what writing was doing and what writing meant, if that makes sense. Like, it was a way of sort of acknowledging, like, who knows if we'd still be friends if you were a 44-year-old person, you know? But that's not the future that came. And so instead there's a sort of like way in which the letters allowed me to communicate with him and in ways that I wanted to, but also to kind of reckon with what I was doing too.
While you were doing a PhD at Harvard, you discovered that your graduate school healthcare offered a free semester of therapy. Why did you decide to take it up?
Well, mainly because it was free, honestly. Like, it's not something I wanted to do necessarily. Like, it's something that friends encouraged me to do. I don't know. It just seemed like a new way of experiencing this thing that I've been kicking around in my head for so long. You know what I mean? Like, that was a period of time when I was pretty open with talking about what had happened. Like, it had only been, I guess, probably like 2 or 3 years at that point. And it was part of how I would explain myself to new friends or to new people I would meet. And so the idea of going to a therapist seemed like just an extension of that, just sort of like meeting another person to talk to about this. I didn't really know what it would mean to feel fixed or to feel better necessarily. And so, you know, it was just something to try.
But you described the lingering impact Ken's death had on you. That you began to live by worst case scenarios. For example, when someone didn't call when they said they would, you'd start to imagine them dead. Or
yeah.
In what other ways did Ken's murder change you?
You know, I think that's the, I guess, like, more negative effect. I think in the years since, like, it's been, what, 24 years, like, I've thought a lot about our conversations and just about the world that he wanted to see and the world that I saw, and his openness and his generosity. Like, in a way, like, even though I'm a caricature in the book, like, even though I'm sort of like okay being self-deprecating, he is the sort of hero of the book. Like, he's the person who I think you're supposed to, or I hope people do, like, understand is the person with a heart and with like a good soul. And, you know, I've just thought a lot over my life about, like, you know, his integrity and his sense of purpose and his sort of willingness to dream. Like, I think that's something that I didn't necessarily want to do as a teenager, because I was very much protecting myself from disappointment. And so when we would talk about, you know, could there be a day when there's like Asian Americans in Hollywood? Could there be a day when this happens or that happens? Like, he was always much more willing to dream about good things happening in the future. Whereas I would be dismissive and think, like, why bother dreaming of something if, you know, like, that thing could fail. And so I think that what I've learned and what I've taken with me is sort of this desire to, I don't know, be more like the person that I thought he was and that he thought other people could be too.
Well, one of the things that therapy seemed to do in the way you recount it is address the guilt that you felt for not being able to do something. I mean, I guess it's called some, I don't know, survivor guilt, or, I mean, like, not being able to do something at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I felt a lot of, it's probably just a very misplaced thing to feel. But because I was there that night and because I drove by later that night, I don't know, like, I just thought that, you know, like, what if I had been there? What if, you know, that was just sort of the world that I lived in for a while. You know, there was also some kind of lingering feelings of guilt of like, well, like, I don't want to hang out the next day. So, like, maybe I'll see you in a couple days, and just sort of whether my sense of, poo-pooing the thing that he wanted to do somehow, like, fated all of this to happen. And so, yeah, I think there was just a lot of, I don't know, like, just projection, just sort of putting oneself proximate to something that was probably going to happen one way or another.
You close the circle with this last therapy session, and the memoir ends kind of at the beginning of your life as a writer. Could you read from what you said in at that time?
Of course. Our session was nearly up. I told the therapist that she had helped me a lot. The chance to hear myself say these things aloud in a nondescript office building had made me feel utterly ridiculous. I was a legendarily self-involved person. I was always the one to run at the first sight of trouble. What could I have done? But she had helped me rearrange some of the furniture in my mind. I knew what I needed to do now, I told her. I needed to figure out how to describe the smell of secondhand smoke on flannel, the taste of pancakes with fresh strawberries and powdered sugar the morning after, sun hitting a specific shade of golden brown, the deep ambivalence you once felt toward a song that now devastated you, the threshold when a pair of old boots go from new to worn, the sound of our finals week mixtape wheezing to the end of its spool. Which metaphors were useful and which were not? What to explain and what to keep secret? The look when someone recognizes you. I'm going to write about all this one day, I told her, and she smiled at me.
Washu, reading from his memoir, Stay True. What are you saying about the relationship between the past and the future there?
I think so much of the late 90s and early 2000s for me was just this process of dwelling in the past, trying to return to it through writing, through archiving, through collecting. And it sort of inhibited my sense of thinking about the future, and what kind of person I wanted to be in the future. And so I think what I learned writing the book is that there's sort of this more intimate connection between the past and the future than I understood at the time, right? And that the tribute to Ken isn't just in the past, but it's also the sort of like good works of the future, that his friends, that our friends in common, that all of us sort of take with us into the world, a piece of him, and that this book is part of that. It's just sort of my version of it. Other people have done it in their lives as well, but that there's a point at which the past compels you to be a different person in the future, and that's not something that I was ready to think about when I was 21 or capable of thinking about, but it's a sort of connection that I made when I was much older.
Stay true is a phrase you and Ken used when you would sign off in a letter or an email. How did you understand its meaning when you were students?
When I was a student, it was just a joke. It was just something that sounded funny and deep to say, even though I don't think it necessarily had any... we never really parsed its meaning. But I think as I grew older, I realized that that idea of being true to yourself is really about being true to like change and openness and just how people might complicate you. That there is no sort of true text to adhere to that is you, that it's a text that's always being rewritten or edited or changed, and that's what it actually means to kind of stay true to oneself.
So it felt right for the title.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a book that is very much like my version of things, so the question of truth might be a little tricky there. But I think it is just about staying true to what the future can hold.
I'm so glad to have the chance to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. This is a delight.
Hua Shu in Brooklyn, New York. His memoir, Stay True, is published by Doubleday. Contributing producer this week is Susan Feldman. The associate producer is Melissa Gismondi. Sandra Rabinovich is the senior producer of Writers and Company. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, from Bulgaria and the Scottish Highlands, Kapka Kasabova. Her book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe, is described as a dazzling work of art and reportage. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.